Our folks think we're babes in arms, huh? Well, we'll show them whether we're babes in arms or not. I'm going to write a show for us and put it on right here in Seaport. Why, it'll be the most up-to-date thing these hicks around here have ever seen.
I can do it. There's nothing to it.
It's so easy.
I love to work at nothing all day.
I'm going to Hollywood.
I'm on my way. I'm making it.
Look, I am the director.
I turn my camera on.
Get close to the mic.
And welcome to the... I don't know what number this is. Welcome to the Bad Idea Podcast.
No one cares about numbers at this point. They're just happy we're still going.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. Anyway, we're your co-hosts, Simon Abrams.
And Stephen Carlson.
And in case you're tuning in for the first time, although I can't really understand how, this is a podcast dedicated to movies that, when put together thematically... it would be a bad idea to watch. We tend to describe ourselves as cinematic dumpster divers, people who like to enjoy the strange and the ecstatically weird of trash cinema.
We go beyond the usual boundaries of what's considered unloved and unseen. So,
is that a dig at...
No, it wasn't a dig at anybody.
Okay. This is about to get awkward real fast. I was loving it, but then I don't know.
I'm a pacifist. I don't make digs at people.
Oh, fuck that. People suck.
Anyway, I came up with the theme this month. I thought that given that our first podcast ever was about films made by and involving Frank Zappa, I thought it would be fun to revisit the theme of musicians dabbling in filmmaking. Mm. But, you know, I didn't want to make it easy on us, so I just, you know, we both decided that it would be in our best interest to go past, you know, like your Neil Young films and things like that, and concert films, and we decided to dig up some real real fun stuff. And the first film we're going to talk about, I figured, you know, that's enough introduction, we'll just jump right into it. First film we're going to talk about is actually the reason I came up with the idea in the first place, because I knew I was going to see it anyway out of morbid curiosity, and I wanted someone else to suffer with me. The film in question is 2016's Officer Down.
All the rumors you've been hearing, they're true. We got ourselves a secret weapon.
Is he dead?
Of course he is.
Officer Down reporting for duty.
Which, as you may have noticed, is a pun. The name of the character is Officer Down. But
with an E.
Yes, but it's also code for what happens when a cop is shot in the line of duty, and that's about as clever as it gets.
Yeah. Officer Down is based on a comic book by Joe Casey and artist Chris Burnham, and I haven't read the source comic, but I tend to think that Joe Casey, the comics that I've read by him, are rather hit and miss. You know, he's like a lot of comics artist. He does try some more outre ideas out, like in something like Automatic Kafka or his Image series Sex, which is a great premise but not great follow through. What I read of it, I think I read the first year or so, and so it's not surprising that, you know, as you watch Officer Down, which is basically like a ripoff slash homage slash pastiche that takes elements from RoboCop and Judge Dredd, that this seems like a comic book that never really was fully fleshed out, or if it was, like, the creators of the movie don't really know or care what made this premise so interesting. I tend to think, based on the adaptation, that this was one of Joe Casey and Chris Burnham's lesser works, because, you know, it doesn't strike me as like a Howard the Duck type project where the humor and the ideas were so idiosyncratic and weird that they were just like, what if we were to just try to translate this without getting fully how to do this kind of humor or these ideas?
Well, I don't know, my phone to look this up to confirm, but I think the screenwriter was also one of the involved with the comics, so
yeah.
I think
Chris Burnham, I think, was involved too.
Yeah, but so it was clearly meant to be I can only assume a straight translation of the source material.
I'm not saying it's not faithful. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I'm actually implying the opposite. Oh, Joe Casey, the writer of the comic.
Oh, there you go.
Was the screenwriter.
You're implying the comic itself is not terribly good.
Yes, I am implying that.
Okay.
And by implying, I mean saying it.
The comic itself is probably not very good.
I mean, yeah, it's. Let's face it, I read some shit by Joe Casey. That's all I'm saying. It's possible that this is shitty, too.
So he's not money in the bank every time?
I mean, he's human. He's, you know, it makes sense. I'm not saying that.
Well, he's human, but Officer Down is not human. How's that for a transition?
Fuck off. Yeah, is this your way of saying it's your turn to talk? Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
No. After that, you're going to have to talk.
I just saw the opening for the transition. The premise of the film is that the title character is, or should I say titular, in case Alan Scherstel's listening?
Nah, he's not listening.
Okay. The title character is a super cop for a future LAPD that is besieged by drugs and gangs and stuff. That essentially it looks like Death Wish 3, but ported to New Detroit.
I'm sorry, you didn't say the full title. Death Wish 3.
There's a subtitle to Death
Wish 3? Oh, wait, sorry, I'm confusing with Death Wish 4. Go on.
Yeah, Death Wish 4 has a subtitle. Death Wish 3.
I was like, The Crackdown. I was like, wait, no, that's
4.
That's fuck.
3. but, yeah, so it's, you know, that very sort of, it's a throwback to that sort of 80s Reagan paranoid inner city, like, oh, the gangs and drugs are going to kill us all! We need to believe in cops! Which is a weird position to take, I mean, given the current political climate, but also given the film's own attitude towards its officers. Like, it spends the first, I'd say, 30 minutes or so setting up a sort of conflict between the idea and ambition, you know, like the ideal of being a policeman and the actual job.
Yeah, but this is like the idea of the zombie premises in a weird way, kind of perfect, because this idea goes back even before the Reagan era. You know, this is the typical,
well, of course.
Not the progenitor of it, but certainly the most iconic example of this type of, this town is filthy, and it's a den of urban crime, and only I can save it from itself, is Dirty Harry.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you see that in, you know, the Nixon 70s, obviously, Return to Law and Order. You can reel that back into the 50s JD films and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, these things, of course, don't happen just in a vacuum, but it's just the way that the premise is fleshed out definitely reminded me mostly of an 80s spin on it. It's very,
oh, real World Cop,
very garish, sure. And neon, and essentially it looks like the guys who did Crank.
I mean, they even have a line early on where they say, this drug that we're manufacturing is Super Crank.
Which is straight from RoboCop 2, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's the Neville Dean and Taylor. Yeah, it looks very much like someone was like, oh, Neville Dean and Taylor should have made Dread instead of the British dude who made Vantage Point.
Peter Watts, whatever.
I think it's Pete Travis, that's it.
Pete Travis, yeah.
What would that look like if we did that? But Neville Dean and Taylor don't want to make the film. We'll have a...
Pete Travis, yeah.
We'll have one of them produce, and then we'll get the guy who directs Slipknot's videos, who's also their drummer, by the way, to make it.
One of their drummers.
He's one of the dudes in the masks, and he's one of their founding members, and who cares? Slipknot is boring.
I remember I used to actually like them when I was in, like, middle school. I remember, actually...
That's the age you're supposed to like Slipknot at.
And then I re-listened to them, and I was like, this makes me feel dirty, but I actually kind of like it. Even though it's not good music, it gives me the nostalgias. And then I was just like, what the hell's wrong with me?
I listened to them when they were first coming up too. I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I never went back to it.
I like your past tense voice is almost as squeaky as mine.
Oh, this is interesting. Ha ha. Hi, everybody. I'm Steve Carlson. I'm so young. I'm so young.
Apparently, when I was younger, I was Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. Aren't we all?
Yeah.
But in our youth, we are all Mickey Mice.
But yeah, just so yeah, I mean the very stylistically, this is very indebted to the Neville Dean Taylor films, but without, as weird as this sounds to say, without their intelligence or their coherence, it's just kind of, you know, it's haphazard style and flash and attitude splattered onto the screen, just like, here, take this.
I'll do you one better. It's not even a matter of lack of intelligence, a matter of lack of inspiration. Because let's face it, Crank 2 has a scene where a guy gets sodomized in the butt with a shotgun. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to come up with that idea.
It also has a scene where the protagonist and the dude he's fighting turn into kaiju.
Yeah. So, again, intelligence, meh. Or, you know, David Carradine as, what was it, Poondong.
Essentially playing fucking Fu Manchu.
Yeah, as a character named Poondong. So, like, I don't know. I tend to think that it really is just a matter of, like, of kineticism and the ability to take, that ephemeral ability to take something that you were inspired by, like RoboCop, like Judge Dredd, like whatever, and throw it in a blender and actually make something of it. The ability to synthesize your influences, which we're always talking about, and I don't think these guys were able to do it. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like there are scenes where, like, it also reminded me of Rob Zombie. Like, there's scenes with, like, killer nuns, there's scenes with,
It indulges what could be stereotypically said to be a lot of zombies' worst impulses.
Yes. It basically feels like what a Rob Zombie film looks like, according to people who don't like Rob Zombie.
Saw 31. I'm sorry, I know you like that film.
Yeah, it's a good film.
No, but, what I struggled with was, it was around halfway, I think the film just kind of gives up and is just like, fuck it, we'll give you the bloodbath you guys want. That's fine. Here's a kung fu battle scored to a goddamn Billy Squire song for some reason. Here's
Zen Master Flash. Isn't that funny?
Fucking, oh god. The whole bit where he's speaking in subtitles for like his first two scenes, and then they decide, you know what? We don't want to keep this gag going. Like, the character literally says, fuck these subtitles.
Yeah.
And then he starts talking in you know, like, the flappy lip type dubbing that was, you know, that recalls old kung fu movies. And incidentally, he's being played by a black dude. Yep. For reasons which are just, I guess, to avoid the charges of racism, but...
Well, they just wanted to trick people into thinking sort of that they had a member racism, of the Wu-Tang Clan. That was it. They were just like, we got the famous Wu-Tang Clan member, the SZA. You know, remember him, the SZA?
You know, Zen Master SZA. Yeah, but I think the thing that kind of bothered me, I hesitate to say bothered me, but the thing about it that I most kind of wanted the film to be better about was, I mean, if you look at the way Officer Down dresses, it's a very stylized sort of cop uniform, but it's, you know, tight fitting and there's buttons and the hat is very tall and there's a stylized emblem on it that looks for all the world like a Nazi cross. And it's just the way they've designed the character, it seems like they're pointing towards, like, well, I mean, you saw what Starship Troopers did, we could do that too. And it's frustrating because it's like, you can see there's just enough of them trying things like that, like trying little bits where it's like, oh, well, we understand the implications of the situation.
We're just not going to do anything.
We're just not going to actually do the work to get there.
Yeah. It's all on the surface, and it just is very boring.
Yeah. It's one of those films where, yeah, you have all this stuff, like, yeah, you have killer nuns, including one played by Alison Lohman in a completely thankless part where her entire role is to shush someone and get her head blown off.
Yep.
I'm glad her career is going well. And, you know, our introduction to the character is him going down on a woman, and there's an on-screen orgasm counter.
Yep.
He gets to 14 the first time, and I think later in the film he gets to, like, 35.
Yeah, 35, 40 something.
Yeah. Like an establishing shot of Los Angeles is tagged as motherfucking LA.
Ooh,
so yeah. It's very like in your face attitudinal, like this ain't your daddy's cop film.
Oh boy.
And then it turns out to be, you know, just the same thing as Judge Dredd and RoboCop.
I kind of like my daddy's cop film.
a lot of great cop films came out in your daddy's day.
Yeah, my daddy had some good cop films. Hi, daddy.
Hi.
Anyway,
but yeah, that's why this is also a frustrating film to talk about, because it is all surface. It's all flash and lens flares and bad colors and the dude from Slipknot not knowing how to choreograph fight scenes so that they make sense. And but it's also not bad enough to deserve the hyperbolically awful reviews it got.
Yeah,
it's just kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, it's one of those films you look at on Netflix and be like, did I see that?
Oh yeah, I did.
All right, okay, what else can I look at?
What else is on here? Speaking of what else is on, let's go to the next film.
I believe the next film we're going to talk about is something we just watched a couple hours ago.
Fading.
Yeah. It's the Insane Clown Posse movie, Big Money Hustlers.
Yeah.
Can't believe it, man. He was my homie. I love this fool like a brother. Damn. I never seen it coming. The worst thing about it was it was all over some money. Why's it always gotta be about some bitch-ass money?
And this one, we almost had to disqualify on a technicality because, despite the fact that we're highly involved in the creative process, neither member of the Insane Clown Posse actually directed it. The director's name escapes me right now because I don't feel that's information worth retaining.
John Caffiero.
John Caffiero, okay. But it turns out he's actually a musician as well.
He's the singer for a pop-punk supergroup named Osaka Popstar.
Yeah, so we were able to go forward with this after all, and I'm sure we're both glad that we did.
Well, let's put it this way. Wasn't one of my more inspired choices.
I'm guessing it's a great film if you're a juggalo.
God bless you, Nathan Rabin, but you're wrong.
I hate to be that guy who's like, I think you have to be part of this group to understand this, but...
No, I understood.
You have to be a juggalo to get this.
No, it's not a matter of getting, though. Like, that implies that some of this shit went over our head. It's not that we don't get it. It's just that we don't care.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, there's things in the film that are, you know, callbacks to various bits of their albums or whatnot. I don't know.
Never mind. I find the idea that, like, just because something is a subculture means that as an outsider, it's a two-way street. You can come into a subculture and be completely ignorant, and your ignorance does not make you entitled to make pronouncements that are like, oh, well, look at this, it's all blah, blah. But it's also just a matter of, like...
Would you do it exactly like that if you were confronted with a juggalo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, look at this.
And then the juggalo would be like, yo, you want some Faygo?
And I'd be like, you are white trash, sir. Let me adjust my monocle and harumph. No, but yeah, I honestly feel like this is the kind of movie where it's like, no, I got this. I'm going to be defensive and dickish about it, but I got this, and I just don't care. It feels like the kind of movie that, like, if Richard Elfman in Forbidden Zone mode had done this movie, I would have been all over it, but it just, it's like the last movie we just talked about. It's very uninspired.
It's pretty interminable, actually. It's like, it's the sort of film that on its face I want to like, because it's these guys going out and basically making the film they want to make because, you know, this shit cracks them and their friends up. So they're making a movie to crack themselves up and, you know, maybe get some of their fans, give some of their fans a jolly and whatever. Cool. Great, guys. I love that you guys have the money and the wherewithal to do things that make you happy.
Yeah.
But what makes you happy is endless scenes of a dude in clown paint saying the word motherfucker 15 times in 30 seconds. And that's not terribly entertaining. by most standards, I would say. I don't know. Maybe is it just me?
No, it's not just you.
I'm watching this film and I'm forced to, you know, cast about for things to hang on to, like the fact that they managed to rope Rudy Ray Moore into the film to play Dolomite.
And Rudy Ray Moore, whose Dolomite is a significant influence on one of the characters, Sugar Bear, played by Shaggy Two Dope. He is a Dolomite-style pimp who goes around threatening the criminal empire of Violent J.
I don't think he's a pimp. I think he's supposed to be a San Francisco cop.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Hold on. Oh, yeah, he's a super cop. You're right.
Yeah. Remember, that's why they call him Super Balls.
I think that is a reference to ICP's music. I think there is actually a song called Super Balls.
Yeah.
I saw it in the end credits. it's the kind of movie that, like, I can see piecemeal them throwing together all their favorite shit from the Adam West Batman.
Yeah, they have little Adam, like, Batman transitions with the Hatchet Man.
Yeah, right down to the fucking Dutch angles.
Yep.
There's that. There's wrestling call-outs. Mick Foley has a cameo. Mm-hmm. Constantly breaking the fourth wall. I bet these guys love Mel Brooks. There's just, like, a ton of stuff that's, like, it should be on my level. And, like, I admit, I laughed one time when one character... Because they have the guts to have their flunkies and themselves make fun of each other so much. Like, even one of the main characters wears, as you said, like, a ridiculous chest hair piece on his chest.
It looks like he's wearing a merkin, but, like, a merkin for, like, the Jolly Green Giant on his chest.
Right, and there's jokes at the expense of these guys about implications of gay sex. There's stuff about, like, there's just, like, all this weird stuff that,
two of the villains are defeated by... Essentially by being pointed out that they're not hard street guys, they're sissy-ass white boys from the suburbs.
Yeah.
And their parents come to take them home.
Yeah, and one of them is a character named Big Stank, who at one point...
And the other's Little Poot.
Yeah, and Big Stank at one point blurts out, "Man, rub his butt!" Which, you know...
as a way for someone to pay proper homage to his boss.
Yeah, that's a thing that happened. Or the bit where there's a robbery going on in a diner.
A donut shop,
and the guy is in an ape suit, and he just yells, "I'm in an ape suit, that means I don't give a fuck." And that was funny.
Yeah, it's like, every time I would, like, be ready to give up on the film, something like that would happen. I mean, Harlan Williams is in this movie, and he's the highlight. Do you understand how sad a movie has to be for Harlan Williams to be the highlight?
Yeah, he had, like, one or two good lines, like...
"I was daydreaming about your yeasty esophagus.
You honey-glazed whore."
Or the bit where he's in the donut shop, and he's just playing with the donuts, trying to make a Shaggy 2 dope laugh. Donut ghost. Donut gentleman from London.
Or when he wants to
rub... Donut owl.
When he wants to rub Shaggy 2 Dope's shoulders, and he says that it's like one of those Norwegian bathhouses.
Yes. It's like he's just been given this space to just make up his own shit and make a more interesting film than what we actually got.
Or how about that guy named Misery with a Z and a Y, two Ys,
yes.
Playing some guy named Green Willie who has a jewel-studded train conductor hat. That looks like he's a refugee from Lazy Town.
Yes. It's because he's supposed to be the gold man. He sells all the fake gold. So they basically painted him gold from head to toe.
Yeah, it's a...
Yeah.
Makes much more sense now.
And then they called him Green Willie instead of Gold Willie.
Yeah, I don't...
This is a film where criticism is kind of beside the point, I guess. It's like... And that's, like, any angle that you can beat it at, it's like, it knows. Like the whole Dolomite thing. It's like, they literally brought in the actual Dolomite to criticize the main character for ripping off Dolomite. Like, they Marshall McLuhan themselves.
Yeah, that was...
they brought in Dolomite to be like, "You know nothing of my work!"
Yeah. And he's not wrong.
He's not wrong, and... I'm sure Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope are fine gentlemen, and I'm sure their fans are nice people.
Hi, Nathan Rubin.
Please don't come and hurt us.
Nathan Rubin's not coming to hurt us.
Yeah, it's the other fans I'm worried about. They seem like they could hurt people.
Why would they want to? We already hurt ourselves by watching this film!
Wah, wah.
I don't know why I was doing a Trogdor right there. That's Roof Cottages!
Trogdor! Are we burninating the countryside? Burninating the peasants?
Yeah.
Burninating the juggalos?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's Roof Cottages!
I don't think we're getting anything else out of Big Money Hustlers.
No, we're not.
No. So, from going from one hip-hop artist who made a movie to amuse himself to another hip-hop artist who made a movie, ostensibly to amuse himself, I guess, but this one turned out so much better.
Yeah, this movie is called Killa Season.
It's by made by Cam'ron.
Cam'ron with no E, the apostrophe between M and R.
Who in a bid for respectability, bills himself in the credits as Cam'ron Giles, which I assume is his birth name.
Maybe.
Yeah. And on the face of it, it's a pretty standard, like, rise and fall Scarface type film. Everyone in the film has Scarface posters everywhere. But it's basically like a Scarface made by someone who didn't understand Scarface was supposed to be a cautionary tale. Which isn't an uncommon thing.
Yeah, it feels like ghetto version of The Public Enemy, the Jimmy Cagney film, except instead of ending, because he can't seem to bear the idea of, like, having this guy hit rock bottom, he just ends the movie abruptly before, like, shit goes down.
Right when things are reaching that crisis point where everything's going to go bad, he's just like, no, I'm done.
Yeah, he doesn't even, like, say his character will return in a sequel, James Bond style. He just is just like, nope, that's where it is.
You can fill in the rest from here. You saw all the fun stuff.
Yeah.
But
this movie is pretty fun, though.
It is exactly the film Cam'ron wanted to make, and there's something glorious in that.
Yeah, it was kind of great to see this guy who clearly didn't have much technical polish or understanding or even think a lot of the big ideas of this film out or the implications of, you know, what he's doing with the characters out. It's pretty interesting to see him, like, work his way through practical problems, like using voiceover narration and using a lot of, like, narrative devices that, like, you associate with, like, more sophisticated filmmaking, but the guy is doing on, like, a shoestring budget. And he creates this, like, very convoluted, complex narrative about this guy. And so, like, he talks about, like, so the rise part of the story, the rise of the rise and fall story is fairly intricate. You know, he's talking about how he made deals with some local gangsters to move his drug product, how he stole a storefront for legitimacy by killing the store owner, how he, you know,
hired some Italian guys to cart the body away.
Yeah.
Which is where we get this priceless fucking exchange between these two guys cutting up a body where they're just like getting off on, like dude says, cutting this shit up gives you a fucking hot on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the bodies that pile up in the crosshairs are as a result basically of this savage takeover, like this poor little girl who dies this really comical death.
This completely pointless fucking...
Yeah, it's like you think that, like, maybe he's gonna learn a lesson from this or something. No, he flashes back to it once, but it's like like you said, it's not a cautionary tale, because that implies that there's, like, ideas about, like, repentance and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it just is not there. Mm-hmm. Like, the women in this movie are ridiculous. There's a angelic stick figure woman best friend who tries to steer him towards the path of justice, and then there's, like, a hood rat style wife. And at one point
the wife who's mentioned in one scene.
Yeah. Twice.
Well, no, I mean, it's shown in one scene.
Yeah, before that.
But, like, she gets one scene just so we can have excuse for a sex scene where the only nudity is Cameron's ass.
Yeah. Yeah, like, this is a... Exactly. There's this weird... Again, it feels like there's no thought... There's no follow-through, basically, but there are moments of inspiration along the way that make this really kind of... dynamic. Like, it's very dynamic storytelling, and it reminded me a bit of, like, some of the techniques and the make-do wizardry of, you know, a filmmaker like Chester Novel Turner.
Mm. What it reminded me of is, it reminded me of basically a modern update of some of those, you know, some of the low-budget, completely black-produced blaxploitations, like Super Soul Brother, or The Guy from Harlem, shit like that, you know?
Yeah.
Like you know, the stuff that wasn't being funded by Warner Brothers. Just, you know, guys going out and being like, I'm gonna make a fucking movie, let's do this.
Yeah. I gotta say, I thought that we were gonna have much more arguments about this film because there are aspects of it that I was just like, I was struggling by the end to accept that a movie that can be so viscerally exciting to watch could be so conceptually thin. That, like, it was really a matter of, like, I was responding to this, like, amateur filmmaker's technique and his energy.
The excitement of it, yeah.
It was really kind of interesting because, like, I ended that movie thinking, man, this movie's good, but it's not all that. And I felt like I would have to fist fight you today, but, like, no, this is, it's an interesting but flawed movie, and I think people really should see it. It's on YouTube.
It is on YouTube.
It's 128-minute glory, and it doesn't feel that long. That's the thing. Like, yeah. I was watching it, I started watching it Friday night, 11:30 p.m. Come 1:40, I was totally just like, well, that evening flew by.
Yeah, I was expecting this to be an absolute slog, and instead I'm just like, I could watch more of this, I'll be honest.
I'd like a sequel. If you're out there, Cameron, I'd love a sequel.
And it has to do with a lot of the energy and the workarounds that Cameron found for certain conundrums. Like, there's a bit where he has to kill somebody in an apartment, but he has to figure out a way to cover up the sound of the gun going off. Mm-hmm. So he has kids outside throwing down those little firecracker popper things.
Yeah.
Like some broke-ass Boogie Nights.
Yeah, that was some Hughes Brothers shit, man.
It was like, you know, fine, man, it works. You know what? Suspension of disbelief. I'll go with you on that. But, like, the bits that stuck out for me were the parts where I guess you realize the limits of the ambition that he's trying to work with and the budget. Mm-hmm. Like, there's one bit where it's supposed to be like a moment of triumph, but they're like where he's like finally coming into his own and, you know, like becoming like the street guy. The bit where he's given the speech to his friends who are helping him deal marijuana, mm-hmm. and he's trying to convince them to go big into coke.
Yeah,
but it's like there's
is a Ferrari. Yeah, this is Honda. Yeah, and he slurs his words so it sounds like he says Hyundai.
Yeah, and. You caught that too. Oh, cool.
Yeah. I was like, Hyundai?
Yeah.
What do you got against Hyundai?
But he prefaces that with this, like, unusually woke rant about how America is rigged against black guys. Like, America doesn't give us a fucking plan B.
Yeah.
This shit is not scheduled for us. So basically, get what you can, because the man's going to keep you down.
Yeah, it was kind of fascinating, but of course, that's a thread that's promptly dropped.
It is, but it was just nice to see it, you know, like even nodded towards, I guess.
No, yeah,
and it's not in a way like Officer Down, where it's like I'm just paying lip service to the underlying theme here, but it's in a way where the film in its way follows through on that theme. It's showing how a black man can make it in a society that doesn't want him to make it,
and then how basically his downfall is brought on by his own
hubris,
caricaturish, over-sexualized nature.
Yes.
Yeah. This movie ends with a character like having his two girlfriends fighting over him, and it really does resort to cliches that are ultimately kind of offensive and obnoxious. More accurately,
yeah.
And I don't know. Like,
the well, let's be fair. The portrayal of women in this film is not exactly the most flattering. Like, even the one positive female influence in his life, who is this woman who was a friend of his since he was three.
Yeah, one of his two girlfriends.
Yeah, yeah, she ends up, he puts her through college because she gets hooked on drugs. So he, like, cleans her up, and even though he's a drug dealer, he's like, he doesn't want to see her in that life. So he cleans her up and gets her through college, and then she repays him by fucking him.
Yeah.
Like, well, this is what you've earned this. You're the good guy. Like, okay. You know, kind of reinforcing that idea that, well, that's what women are for. But
I mean, all the women in this movie are either over-sexualized or they're kind of, they're crackheads. They're drug addicts. And, like, his mother, who is a...
She's supposed to be the stabilizing influence in his life, but she's also a cokehead.
So, yeah, there is on that, in that sense, like, whether he's thought it through or not, there is, like, a some kind of commentary about...
And let's be fair, that's probably...
The nature of the environment that these people grow up in...
That is also a reflection of...
gangsterism and hoodism and thugism.
Other isms.
That aren't really words that I'm just saying.
And it's also a reflection of the fact that this is essentially, let's be fair, it's a visual gangster rap album.
Mm-hmm.
There is a corresponding soundtrack of the same name, which is the only Cameron album not available on Spotify, as I found out over the weekend.
Okay.
There was something that caught me here. It was like there's the bit where his uncle dies and gives him the $200,000, leaves him the $200,000. After the most amazing funeral scene.
Yeah.
Where, it, like, no one's... instead of concentrating on the mourners, the camera's cutting between two different conversations with two guys in Cameron's crew trying to get laid.
Yeah.
One of them with like, an 80-year-old woman.
Yeah.
And she's like, do you know how old I am? He's like, I don't care.
Yeah.
But...
That was pretty great.
So there's a whole bit afterward where his grandfather leaves him a $200,000.
That was cool. Yeah. He said... Yeah. No, that was, what did he say? He says, like, that was the shit or something.
That was the shit, yeah.
Yeah.
And, in a true hustle way, he uses it to buy a hot Lambo from a dude in the neighborhood who deals in that sort of thing. And then he immediately flips the Lambo for regular and manages to buy a Range Rover plus another hot Lambo in the color he wanted. Right. So, it's like, okay, respect to the hustle. But at the same time, there's something here where, okay, you've got this depiction of success as consumption. As, you know, the cars.
Overindulgence,
and the jewelry,
yeah.
And the fur.
Excess, yeah.
But at the same time, Cameron lives in a two-room apartment in Co-op City with his cokehead mom. And the movie's shot on a consumer-level video camera.
Yep.
So, whether intentional or not, it lends kind of a poisoned edge to the consumption. Like, it kind of empties it out. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that was the point. Which I don't know if it was. I don't think it was. Because, again, the film doesn't exactly function as a cautionary tale. But there is that level where it's like, yeah, all this shit is hollow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's also just, you know, just great moments of amusement, whether or not they're self-aware. Like, my favorite line was a bit where a dude comes to deliver a package to Cameron, and he's carrying it in, like, this shoebox in a bag. Like, just completely not hidden at all. And Cameron just looks him straight in the face and says, "What the fuck, you got a fucking sneaker box in a Dwayne Reed bag?" And it's like, that is such a New York moment right there.
Right.
But... And it's a really fascinating and conflicted film, but it's honest, you know? It is what it is, and it's not going to be anything else other than itself. And I can respect that. That's I enjoyed this film a lot more than I expected to, and not in, like, a, oh, look at the man making the movie he doesn't know how to make, you know? In the, like, the, I could get down with this. I mean, I could see myself working on this crew.
Yeah, it's the thing, like, I can totally tell that, like, my distance from the type of life depicted in this film makes my enjoyment of it necessarily of a cultural tourism variety.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I do respond, I think, less to ideas of whether or not it is a realistic portrayal of life, and more to the idea of, as we were talking about the technique and the, you know, just the energy of it. I found the thoughtfulness of it to be, and the way that he just problem solves to be really interesting.
Yeah, it successfully projects the image that he wants.
Yeah.
And one more scene I wanted to mention that is just, when you get talking of, you know, on your feet problem solving, not in a filmmaking perspective, just from a narrative perspective, there's a that bit where a dude's, one of his henchmen, I think it's Hell-Rel, is dealing drugs in the bodega, and then a cop comes in.
Yeah, and
the dude grabs a jar of peanut butter and just shoves the drugs into the peanut butter and then smooths out the top.
Yeah.
And the cop's like, "What you got there?" Just peanut butter. You want some? And the cop's like, "No thanks, I'm allergic."
Yeah. My thing was that scene like that, and like a lot of the scenes in the movie, the biggest complaint I have is that like a lot of it just feels like this guy doesn't know when to, doesn't have any instincts about when to yell cut or when to stop filming. So like there'll be a scene where like people, to show that the product that he's getting is good, you see a rather prolonged and seemingly endless scene where two women are shitting on a tarp out a whole bunch of drugs.
Oh, yeah.
And it is...
Oh, God.
It just goes on forever.
But
it keeps cutting to the shit.
Yeah, but at the same time, the scene runs about 5 minutes. It's a lot of shit. And it's a much better argument for the debasement and a removal of humanity of the function of the drug mule than the entirety of Maria Fuller Grace. So it's got that going for it.
There you go. Well, you went there.
Damn right I did.
Can we talk about my favorite movie of this podcast?
So we're going to move on to the last film, which is a quote-unquote documentary.
Documentary.
By a fella named Joel Gilbert, who you might recognize from a film we talked about a couple podcasts back called Paul McCartney Really Is Dead, The Last Testament of George Harrison.
Oh, yeah.
And this is also a music documentary.
Documentary.
Called Elvis Found Alive.
Yes.
I always knew that sometime in my life, I mean, I had a feeling that sooner or later somebody would find me alive. There are good reasons why I had to do what I did.
And just to make sure we adhere to the theme here, Gilbert, we were able to backdoor him because he heads up a Bob Dylan cover band called Highway 61 Revisited.
Which is the name of his production company, Highway 61 Entertainment.
Yes. And I just wanted, before we start talking about Elvis Found Alive, I think the fact that he heads up a cover band kind of gets into something that I was noticing about these films, in that all the films that we've watched today, in one way or another, reflect the ethos of the music made by their core, creative personas. Like in this, the Slipknot movie is very noisy and fast and obnoxious, and the ICP movie is indulgent and vulgar and dumb as hell, and in a relatively innocuous way. Like it's just tits and fat chicks and motherfucker and Faygo. And, the Cameron thing, like we talked about, is basically a Cameron album, just with pictures. And this...
is not like Elvis at all.
It's not like Elvis at all, but it's definitely... it definitely feels like the work of a dude who fronts a fucking cover band. Because it's inauthentic and false and fucking...
it's dangerous.
Yeah.
This is why I love it. Okay. So remember when we talk, I gotta get into this.
Go for it,
I'm fucking itching to talk about this film.
Go for it.
Elvis Found Alive is similar to Paul McCartney Really Is Dead, which is another cool air quote mockumentary, which is how it sold on Joel Gilbert's website. And there are one of two ways to watch this film, as with Paul McCartney Really Is Dead. You can either, let's be charitable and start with the first reading.
Okay.
That this is in fact a parody piece collecting all the various conspiracy theories and ideas about Elvis's fake death and history and all of the mythology surrounding Elvis that fans want to believe. So we start basically from the point of view of Joel Gilbert, who, using the Freedom of Information Act, types into the FBI's website a request for all the FBI's files on Elvis Presley. 10 days later, he gets
which is a record for an FOAI request.
Sure, and I wouldn't know.
FOIA.
Yeah, and he gets 10 days later a heavily redacted form, which the ink is so wet that he's somehow able to unredact it, and then is able to go
That's just how the government does shit, right?
Very sloppily, and he tracks down. What's this guy's name? He tracks down someone named John Burroughs, one of Elvis's 70s aliases in Simi Valley, California. And he says, I know who you are. And he basically threatens him in a very polite way that he's going to do a press conference, which is, in the movie, the idea of fake Elvis, or dead zombie Elvis. Let's call him zombie Elvis.
Zombie Elvis works for me.
He says, zombie Elvis says, you're gonna hold a press conference otherwise. And this guy's voice, like the George Harrison voice in Paul McCartney Really Is Dead, is comically off.
Sounds like George Harrison, if George Harrison had a head cold and was actually Cockney.
Yes, so nothing like George Harrison. Yeah, this guy, Elvis Presley, sounds like he's a stone's throw away from Bill Clinton. And he is, seriously, it's really kind of fascinating because it starts off as a fairly innocuous rehashing of the Elvis story. He was good to his mama. He was unaware somehow of the sexual implications of his hip wiggling on stage because he was just feeling the music. He was aware that the Colonel, what's his name?
Tom Parker
was bad for him, or that there was something up that wasn't always in his best interest, but he went along with him because he was a good... What was the distinction they make? That he was a good...
He was a good promoter. He wasn't a good manager.
Yes. And so it promotes this dangerous idea that Elvis was somehow so naive, so helpless, that he did not and was not responsible for his music. Responsible for the genius behind his music. They even float this idea that his songs, which has his name on, the songs that have his name on them, were just, they just put his name on there because it made me sound smarter than I am. And it's very dangerous because this is a product designed for, it's a made-on-demand DVD. You're not gonna just stumble upon this if you're just a layperson. There is no audience for a film called Elvis Found Alive, let alone a 128-minute film called Elvis Found Alive that's just gonna happen upon this in the wild. It's a made-on-demand film. And the idea that Elvis fans are just gonna watch this, they're gonna eat this shit up, and it's just interesting to me that he's in some ways attacking his audience. So let's go on. The idea, it gets weirder from there and insidious.
And that's the thing, yeah. It's that's just setting you up for the actual insidious shit that the film's going to whip out later.
Yes. The implication, and the weird shit is actually my favorite part. So it takes about an hour, but there's implications that he was friendly with Sinatra, who was had ties with the mob, and that he was getting tired of the image that he had in the movies, and his naivete is actually explained by his fascination / weird fetishized image of himself as a Captain Marvel Jr. style comic book hero.
Yes, the entire film is framed through Captain Marvel Jr. comic books, and it's very tiresome.
I had read all the Captain Marvel Jr. comic books. I realized I looked just like him.
It's very tiresome because half of these panels are clearly sutured together Frankenstein style through the photo booth application on his MacBook. And it's just, it's really fascinating because it's like, I'll get to this later, but I'm trying to imagine the audience for this just thinking, like, yep, that's my Elvis. We're always reading them comic books. And so we go on, and we find out that Elvis faked his death because he was involved with the FBI in their quest to shut down the Weather Underground, and he had a weird distaste for the Black Panthers, which there's no connection with that, but they cover their ass and say that he liked civil rights, like Martin Luther King, but he didn't like the Black Panthers because violence bad.
He didn't like them uppity black people. He liked the respectful black people.
Yes, and he didn't like the Beatles because they were promoting drugs.
One of the many times that the filmmaker tips his hand is, I forget exactly what the context is, but he has Elvis use the word Negro.
Yeah.
But he hasn't pronounced it as Negro.
Yeah.
Which is you're going a bit past a dog whistle there.
Yeah.
You're coming real close to just stating your actual intentions.
But
before we go further, I have to say Joel Gilbert, the director of this, is also on camera as the head of Highway 61 Films and the interviewer of Elvis. And Joel Gilbert looks like a man who may have spent the entirety of the 80s made out of cocaine.
He looks like he modeled his look after revivalist period Bob Dylan.
Yes.
Like, to the point of, like, freakish. The point where they show footage of revivalist era Bob Dylan in this film, and I'm just like, no, that's definitely what he did. Yeah. He definitely tried to look like this Bob Dylan.
He looks like Jesus Dylan.
Yep. And so basically, this idea is that, like, Elvis was very into this idea of that he liked guns, that he liked
America.
He had this chaste fascination with heroism. And what's this quote? He says, "If I could help save America, maybe it was my true destiny that God had prepared me for."
Yes.
You know, everyone can be a superhero for America.
And this idea was that, like, he hated Bill Ayers. He hated the Weather Underground. He hated anything.
He hated the mob.
He hated drugs. Even though, and Gilbert, if we are to believe that Gilbert is making a mockumentary, then we would have to give credence to the idea that there are several scenes in this film where he does tip his hand overtly and to read it in that,
like,
sense.
If we're reading this as a mockumentary, you mean like the idea that Elvis insists he never did any drugs?
Yes, and he pointedly asks him,
yeah,
but what do you say to the charges of you using drugs? And then he deflects by saying, oh, the only drugs that I took were prescription medication. And then later he backtracks and says, I only found out later that these drugs were bad for me, and that they were being taken in abusive quantities.
Mm.
And it reinforces the film's notion of the artist as a babe in the woods, helpless,
total naive who just wants to do the best for his country.
Yeah. And I think that is simultaneously a pat on the back with one hand to fans, and then a sock in the nuts, because the way that he continues this is...
Well, even beyond the more awful allegations that come out, it's just, it takes the human out of the subject.
Yeah.
It reduces the complexity of a human being to, well, you know, Elvis was a saint and he would never do anything bad, right?
Yeah, the sex implications of his hip movements, totally unintentional. His dealings with women, totally innocent. His love for his mom, totally true.
Totally true. And they leave out the part where, I think, what was it, Priscilla was like 20 years younger than him when they got married?
Yeah.
And wasn't she like 16 at the time, I think?
No, they do mention that, actually.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, basically, there's this subtle mockery of the Elvis faithful, which is ultimately bullshit, because in the end the movie concludes, well, actually let's back up. The story continues that Elvis faked his death because the FBI cautioned him that things were getting too hot for Elvis, that he had gone on a mission to stop Bill Ayers, and that he was basically helping the Tennessee Mafia, the
Memphis Mafia, yeah,
to stop the actual mafia,
yep.
And it led to actual hits of mafia members and takedowns and missions, and it was getting too hot for old Elvis, so he faked his own death using the help of someone named Dr. Nick, which I can't help but think...
Hi, everybody!
I can't help but think that's an actual Simpsons reference. And Dr. Nick helps him plot his death by using a dying patient who suspiciously looks just like Elvis...
But fatter, so that's why Elvis got fat in his last years.
Exactly.
He was trying to look the part.
Because fuck the idea that Elvis just happened to be being run into the ground, and he was human and had flaws like anyone else. Fuck that. Yeah. He was doing it for reasons.
Yes.
And anyway, so they fake the death. The conspiracy goes that basically Elvis used a wax dummy in the casket because I guess the corpse of this guy wound up not being suitable.
The corpse, because he was sick, the guy had lost weight and withered, so that fat Elvis wasn't actually what he looked like anymore.
Yeah, so they basically put a wax dummy in the casket, and to prevent it from melting in the heat, they used an air conditioning unit, which is why they required 9 people to carry the casket. And this is true, because there is footage of conspiracy theory nuts who back this up, and allegations that there were signs that that Elvis was actually alive, including the fact that on his tombstone, his gravestone, it says Elvis Aaron with 2 A's Presley, even though it's Aaron with 1 A, and that the reason they did that was to prevent him from getting a hex put on him. Yes,
yeah. The reason is that Elvis is like, I never thought that a man should see his name in connection with his death, and I didn't want to curse myself.
Yeah.
And incidentally, that accent I was doing there, that's about as good as the Elvis accent that's in the film.
It's, let's give him credit there. It's a little better. I'm sorry. Aww. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm patting you on the back.
Okay.
Okay, but yeah, so we follow through to modern day, and this whole time, you know, Joel Gilbert has brought in him with a studio, a former real life Elvis paramour, Celeste Yarnell.
Yes.
Who co-starred with him in at least one picture. I'm trying to think which one it was.
I think it was a couple different pictures. They mentioned him in the film, but I did not retain the information.
I have it here. Live a little.
Yes, that one.
Just take our word for it. She was in some movies with him.
She's mostly famous for her role in Star Trek, I guess.
Yes. So she's in this movie, and she's in on the joke then. If this is a mockumentary, then she's in on the joke, and she's in on the idea that, like, oh, you're really alive, Elvis. And the thing of it is, before she's trotted out in the movie and revealed to be in the room and has a tearful reunion with Zombie Elvis, there is a scene where it goes into one of Joel Gilbert's other conspiracy theory projects, which is his birtherism about former President Barack Obama, who he claims was actually really named Barry Sotero.
A popular conspiracy.
And that he's not articulate, in the words of fake Elvis, and even though he covers his ass by saying, I don't support any political party.
Well, here's the thing. I was reading up on this. Gilbert's conspiracy theories are actually too whack for birthers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, Gilbert doesn't charge that Obama wasn't born in America. He thinks he's American.
Yeah, he just buries Sotero.
He thinks, though, that his father isn't Barack Obama Sr., but I forget the name, but his real father is a Chicago, well-known Chicago-based communist poet and activist.
Oh boy!
Yes.
So yeah. So basically, he has, and let's point out that this movie was made in 2012. So this is before the re-election. Is that right?
Yes. Right? This was made during the election year because Elvis actually makes fake Elvis makes a pointed reference near the end of the film to that he'll make his comeback if Obama isn't elected.
Yes.
Because he can't make his comeback now.
He can't.
Because the government wouldn't let him.
Yeah.
They'd put out a hit on him because the government right now is too un-American, and it's being run by Bill Ayers and Barry Sotero.
They claim that Bill Clinton was sympathetic and that he met with him, even though he was a witness protection program, and that Clinton was going to pardon him, but then the whole Monica Lewinsky thing happened.
Yep.
And there's all this really inspired wackadoo shit in this movie, like the fact that if you look at the Elvis stamp really closely, you'll see an FBI badge.
Oh my god, yes.
Just there's shit like that where I can't help but cackling with glee, but then you get to the ugly ending, and there's 2 or 3 moments where I wanted to just punch your TV screen.
Thank you for not.
And it was the cameo by Celeste Yarnell. It was the birtherism, where he attempts to basically speak to Elvis's established fans and is like, if you believe Elvis, don't vote for Barack Obama, because he won't come out otherwise, like fucking the groundhog on Groundhog Day, apparently.
If we see Obama, then we get four more years of no Elvis.
Yeah, four more years of no more Elvis, or however many decades. Yeah, where Trump's in office.
Where's Elvis?
Fucking where's Elvis? Oh, man.
Well, he is 72 when this film was made. Maybe he just died.
Fuck off. I want zombie Elvis. But yeah, so if there's that, and I think the most fucked up part of this is that there is an actual website called ElvisFoundAlive.com where Joel Gilbert has put together an album of
modern covers and re-recorded Elvis standards.
Yes.
By quote-unquote Elvis.
The real Elvis.
Yes.
And he is actually selling this, and there's even on the last track, which is the only reason I would consider buying this, is there's a Elvis Found Alive rap track.
Yes.
And there's a sample, a 15-30 second sample of it, and it was gut-bustingly excellent.
It's insane. It's
Lord help me. And now I'm back.
You said you had a gun. So I said, honey, I got 10.
And one of the last things we hear in the film over the credits, Gilbert's asking zombie Elvis other questions. And one of them is, what do you think of hip-hop and rap? And of course, Elvis responds with,
there's no talent of any kind. It's not real music.
Yeah, the typical old guy answer.
Typical old white guy answer.
Yes, old white guy answer.
Racist white guy answer.
But you know, then of course you get Elvis's back rap on the soundtrack.
Exactly, because
And incidentally, if you listen to the sample, Elvis is not rapping. He's talking. He's doing that talking thing that he used to do before certain songs, you know, where he'd just be down and talking to the audience. And
yeah. So,
but apparently that's rap now.
Yeah.
Because rap is just when someone's speaking over a beat, right?
Absolutely. I'm white and cranky. So yeah, so there is, we've gone through this movie thoroughly in interpreting it as a mockumentary. The only alternative doesn't deserve any other thought. If this guy isn't actively exploiting Elvis fans, then he is a fucking nutter, which makes him entertaining on a certain level, but...
And considering that when you look at his other credits, specifically for his political documentaries, which include the Obama documentary, Dreams of My Real Father, include a film called Atomic Jihad...
Yeah.
About
not related to Atomic Blonde.
Not related to Atomic Blonde, but it's about the Iranian president whose name I can never pronounce, Ahmadinejad. Thank you. The then Iranian president and the rise of radical Islam, and how apparently Muslims were going to nuke us all. Yeah, there's a whole lot of conspiracy based stuff in his CV, and he's not claiming that stuff is mockumentary. It's just the music documentaries. And so I can only be... And he only started claiming that they were mockumentaries after the release of Elvis Found Alive. So I can only assume that he adopted that party line to keep his ass from getting sued from various parties. Which leads me to believe that his shit is on the level. And this is really what he believes.
See, that's the thing. I tend to feel that this was his more overt attempt at tipping his hand and saying, listen, if you thought that shit was funny, let me just make sure that you guys get that this is a joke. And I feel like it's a more overtly comical film, but that doesn't make it any less insidious and gross and full of crap.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. Whether you take it as a documentary or a mockumentary, you're still left with the essential message.
Yeah, and I bought a copy of this.
Yes. You gave this dude money.
Yeah. On the one hand, I'm not... I got what I wanted. On the other hand, I may need to use your shower.
We can... I can get some gasoline outside. We can light it on fire if you want.
Putting out fire.
With gasoline.
Been so long.
That is not one of the songs Elvis covers on the Elvis is Alive album, incidentally.
You know, it might be. We haven't listened to it. It could be a hidden track.
I didn't recognize it in the track list, but...
No, that's what I'm saying. It's a hidden track.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Well played.
Elvis has been found alive on that. But yeah, it would tie in. We could create our own conspiracy theory because there's the scene in Elvis Found Alive where they're burning Elvis's records.
Oh, and it's that's
and,
right.
And they show clearly the front in the front of this footage. The album that's being burnt is Aladdin Sane.
So it's
makes you think
Elvis was Bowie. That's what it was.
Yep. Even though pop music, according to him, had been downhill after 1970. Oh, we forgot my favorite part of this conspiracy theory. Okay. Oh, my God. My favorite part is the implication that they bankrupted Nicolas Cage because he was getting too close to the truth because of his marriage to Priscilla. Not Priscilla.
No. It was the other way around. It was the other way around. He got close to the truth because of Honeymoon in Vegas.
Yeah.
Which he did because he was a huge Elvis fan.
Yeah.
And he, you know, because he was so big on Elvis, he found out that, you know, found out the truth about Elvis. So they had Lisa Marie marry Nicolas Cage and then keep the marriage going long enough to get his financial records.
Yes.
Which they then turned over to the IRS.
Yes.
Which bankrupted him, which is why he's in every direct-to-video movie now. Elvis is responsible for that.
Thank you, Zombie Elvis. Oh my God, that's my favorite part.
That was one of the few parts Nicolas where I was Cage. that is genuinely inspired.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. There are moments like that. They're not as frequent as they are in Paul McCartney.
Oh, Paul McCartney Really Is Dead is such a cavalcade of fucked up ideas.
I know, because the Beatles mythology is so rife with that shit. Like the ground is so fertile and. You could do so much with it.
Oh, and you know, you forgot about the other ass covering moment during the credits.
Okay.
When Gilbert asks Elvis point blank if he believes that McCartney died in 1966.
Yeah.
And Elvis goes, "No, I don't believe that.
I think it was just some wacky joke with those British guys."
Yeah, it was just some wacky British humor.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man. I guess we have to talk about the Netflix grab bag film now.
Yeah, it's the funny thing is this has happened maybe once or twice before. But it's rare. The Netflix grab bag is supposed to be our respite from the terrible films we like to subject ourselves to. Uh-huh. You know, we don't necessarily get something good, but it's usually not as bad as the bulk of the podcast.
The premise of the Netflix grab bag, if you're joining us for the first time, and you probably aren't, is we choose whose queue we are choosing from, Steve or mine. Then we flip a coin to decide DVD or instant.
Yep.
Then we choose four titles that neither of us have seen by choosing random numbers.
Mm-hmm.
If one of those four is a title that one of us has seen, skip to the next random number.
Yeah, the idea is to kind of clear out the stuff that's in the middle of the queue that you put in with every intention of watching, but it just kind of gets skipped over again and again.
But we forgot the part. The key part is we put those four titles on our respective Twitter accounts, and we have you
vote for them.
Vote and choose.
And this month, we're voting from Simon's instant queue, and you chose for us the minor can sensation from 2013, The Tribe.
So fuck you.
Yes. Yes. You among you who voted for The Tribe, I would like to have words with you. Why would you do this to us?
It's not a very good film.
It's a little more than not very good.
It's bad.
It's extremely bad.
I don't think we
know
it.
The Tribe, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the film, is a Russian film about a young man who goes to a boarding school. And
for the deaf.
Well, I was getting to that part, but...
Shut up. I'll keep going.
He goes to a boarding school and gets involved with sort of the ruling class at the boarding school, which are these young men who call themselves the Tribe. And they run, like, you know, drugs and prostitution and stuff because Euro-miserabilism. And the hook is, of course, that it's all performed by hearing-impaired people using only sign language. And I was aware of that. I was not aware of the fact that the film is untranslated.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting experience. I've seen films
in languages I didn't understand before without subtitles. It's actually how I first saw Houssou.
Just say House.
I like saying Houssou.
Yeah, I'm sure that's really great for you.
It is. It makes me happy.
Mm-hmm. Gives you a pre-appism that just won't die.
Would you like to see it?
No, I'm good. I know all about it.
Yeah. But it's the first time I've seen one that was deliberately left that way. And I can...
What a provocative...
That's the thing. I can understand...
Way
the...
of getting me to feel with the disorientation of what it's like to be one of these characters and unsentimentally experience life through the eyes of these... Oh, fuck off.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I feel about that, in that I understand that the intention is, you know, supposed to disorient the viewer in the way that a deaf person would be disoriented in regular society. But
it strips the scales from your eyes in this completely miserableless European way that recalls Michael Haneke's films. If Michael Haneke were a piece of shit, and I don't know why I'm doing Werner Herzog, but seriously, this movie is technique over substance to the point where you're just watching horrible series of events where this deaf person is committing crimes involving himself with prostitution, murder, drug sales, and it's just fucking sucking the life out of you. You can see it's like something out of Life Force, where the movie screen is just literally just sucking the energy out of you, and it's like that... Ooh, it's just like Matt Zoller Seitz's review of the movie Sphere. And you're just like, oh, Manny, man. Now I'm a man.
You're a man.
A man.
Man. But yeah, no, I mean, I think Herzog's an interesting touchstone because Herzog did do Land of Silence and Darkness.
Yeah.
Which is a marvelous film and an extraordinary way to empathize with the deaf mute. Mutes that he was filming. Another film that came to mind a lot was Kazuo Hara's Goodbye CP.
I've never seen it.
Oh boy, that's a tough film. It's a masterpiece, but yeah, its aim is to very much humanize a bunch of people who suffer from not cystic fibrosis, cerebral palsy. It's cerebral palsy, and show them as just as human as you or I, and doing that involves showing them at their worst, with, you know, like one guy admitting to rape fantasies, or another guy constantly arguing with his wife and physically abusing her.
Yeah, just like in that Crispin Glover movie, is fine, everything is fine, yeah. which is a lot of rape fantasies from the perspective of someone with...
Down syndrome?
Yeah, I guess that's what it is, yeah.
Yeah. But... That film specifically still allows an entry point and a measure of agency to its protagonists.
Yes.
And the tribe, it almost extraordinarily does not. Like it's the way it's shot. It's every scene is an unbroken handheld shot.
Yes.
And they're all, but it's all medium to long shots. It's like there's always a distance between us and the protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
And the film explicitizes that during one sequence. The first time we see the teen girls going out and being pimped, it films them, the negotiations for them being pimped to these truck drivers, from behind the windshield of another truck.
Right.
So that we're literally walled off from the rest of the film. We're being put in the place of... We're scientists in white coats observing this behavior of people who are not like you or I.
Yeah, this isn't even something that Cronenberg would do. And he's often dismissed by his critics as a clinician and, you know, a very distant, cold filmmaker.
But this is essentially human behavior under glass. And it's just... It's just a competition to see how squalid it can get before the director decides to roll the fucking credits.
Yeah, it's pretty... I admired the technique and its ability to get me to constantly, against my will, just within a moment, just pay attention enough to go see what horrid shit's gonna happen next. But by the time that someone is using a hair conditioner to crush the skulls of two sleeping people...
Yeah.
I was just like,
Yeah.
I don't care.
I don't need this film in my life.
Yeah.
I think I wrote here, this film is not interested in these people except as objects to move through an environment. It barely bothers to differentiate between them.
Yeah.
It's like, when the credits roll, you find out these people have names.
Yeah.
The film doesn't bother to ever give us that information in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't care.
Yeah.
And it doesn't care to tell us. It's simply just, look at these people. Watch them do this horrible shit. Eat your popcorn. Go home.
Stroke your chin harder.
Feel bad about yourself.
Yeah.
For not caring more about these disadvantaged fellows or
something. Wallow in your alienation.
Yeah. It's like it got to the point where I wondered if the fact that they didn't bother to translate the dialogue was meant to bring us into the experience of that these people would face every day, or if it was just to disguise how generic the goddamn story is.
Immersive alienation, motherfucker.
Yeah. But I don't know how much else I can say about this film without getting just like viscerally angry about it.
No, I already am viscerally angry.
It's been a while since I've seen a film that I can genuinely like hate in a sort of pipe clearing way. That I forget who the reviewer was, but he talked about Vonnegut's novel Breakfast of Champions that way. But it's been a while since I've seen a film that I hate like that purely. But this is one of them. It's 128 minutes of my life I'll never get back.
Yeah, just as long as the Elvis Found Alive movie. Coincidence.
Bum bum bum.
Yeah, you know, at least Elvis Found Alive was.
It had things I'll remember.
Yeah. Elvis Found Alive made me feel things.
Yes.
Anyway, what's our Netflix grab bag choices for next time?
As if a switch had been turned, as if an eye had been blinked, as if some phantom force in the universe had made a move eons beyond our comprehension, suddenly there was no trail.
And so, yeah, those are our four choices. We will put up a poll for them later. And I don't think we have chosen a theme yet for the next podcast, have we?
Well, if you come down, we can do a something with Odie or something.
We'll talk about that. We'll see what my schedule looks like.
Cool.
All right. So
until next time.
Goodbye, guys. Goodbye. Hey. Don't watch Russian films with deaf people in them.
And don't give money to Joel Gilbert.
Don't give money to Joel Gilbert. He's a bad man.
He's not a good person.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Pull over, cocksuckers!